Hey folks, this is the Contextual Insurgent Podcast, and I'm your host, Aaron Smith. I'm an activist, an analyst, a writer, and a sensemaker. I'm a Republican, a former SFGOP Central Committee Delegate, where I was the Deputy Vice Chair of Communications. As California GOP-endorsed State Senate candidate, where I managed to win 11% of the vote in San Francisco, which, trust me, is better than average. I've also been involved with the firearms community and Second Amendment rights. I was on the cover of Time magazine in November of 2018 for their Guns in America issue. But I'm probably best known for my free speech activism and facing off with hard lefties like Antifa in California and the Pacific Northwest since 2017. The general topic of this podcast series will be politics in the current culture war, as seen from my unique, rather hands-on experience and knowledge, but also intend to include a practical element focused on giving you the conceptual tools to build towards true grassroots, nonviolent political change. You may have noticed lefties usually seem to get what they want regardless of how elections go, and I want to help you change that. You can also sign up for my Substack newsletter at contextualinsurgent.substack.com. I have a weekly newsletter that looks back at some of the highlighted stories of the week and gives you some feedback and analysis of what's happening. If you'd like to support my work, I have a Patreon at patreon.com/EESmith4. That's the number 4. I also have a Cash App at $EESmith4. Again, that's the number 4. For the cost of a mocha frappuccino once a month, you can support my work, which is ultimately about helping you. Hey everyone, it's May 8th, 2021, and this is Daily Dispatch number 19. A couple things I want to talk about today. You may have seen, it's been in the news, there's two particular incidents. One in Portland, and there's another one in Plano, Texas, I've heard it was actually in Frisco, Texas, which is right on the border, apparently. There was some marches, some leftist demonstrations that are blocking streets. You know, I've been talking about this before. There's a lot of these occupations and things going into residential areas, and there's some similarities and some differences here, and I want to kind of hash this out. In Portland, and both of them had confrontations with people. The ones in Portland were arguably far more violent. The one in Frisco, let's talk about the Plano one first, the Frisco / Plano one first. This one was like apparently last Sunday. There was like a BLM march that blocked a major intersection in like off of a freeway. There was actually one of the things that happens, and this happened in Portland as well. A lot of these demonstrations will have lead and rear vehicles when they're actually going down the street. And they also have their corkers, the people on bicycles that we've talked about with the vests that block side streets. Apparently they were marching and they were followed by, you know, their corker vehicles. And they blocked off this major, major intersection on Sunday, this past Sunday, sometime in the afternoon, it sounds like. And, you know, there's, of course, it's by a freeway, so there's a big stack of traffic, and it's very aggressive, people yelling in the street and demonstrating. And there was even a cop, there was one cop standing there doing nothing. Apparently, one of the motorists got so angry, he jumped out of his car and ran up there and was like, get out of the road, get out of the road, and yelling at them. And there's a video of this. The people that were in the demonstration, you know, there was a bunch of them wearing body armor and armed, and there was even in one of the videos you can see like somebody jumps up and he's wearing a mask and a plate carrier and he pulls his pistol out and points it at the guy, and somebody actually kind of grabs it and pushes him kind of away, somebody from, you know, the demonstration side, and the cops immediately jumps in. It's just one cop, and he like starts backing the guy up and, you know, walks him back to his car, and he's being yelled at and, you know, harassed the entire way. The guy was, you know, rightfully angry. You know, and of course there's the blocker vehicles that are right there at the intersection. They've got people in the back of the car and they're yelling at him too. So that happened, and, you know, there's a bunch of people with guns there, like long arms as well, and they were even threatening the guy. You know, some legal observers there. That happened, you know, no one got injured, but it was a very contentious thing. It was a very big guy. He was very angry. And, you know, that's something we've been seeing. We're probably going to continue seeing these types of things where they will demonstrate and seize control of an area. And people get angry, and part of that is they're trying to aggravate people into responding and then, you know, overreacting. Because again, this is the dilemma action stuff that I've talked about. You know, part of it is actually aggravate these people into overreacting and cause a scene and, you know, give a PR victory. The guy didn't really do anything that I think was wrong. I don't think it made him look bad. He was just extremely angry, and he was, you know, had a legitimate reason to be angry. And it's incredibly frustrating. The cop didn't do anything. It was more about trying to keep him away. Like, I doubt they had permits. I can pretty much guarantee they didn't, because, you know, it was just one cop and there wasn't anyone else, any escorts. Usually they have an escort if it's a permitted march, precisely because of these reasons. And, you know, really part of the whole point of not getting a permit, too, is it's like flexing power and like testing the local government to see if they'll actually do anything. Apparently, the mayor, or the former mayor of the town, was there, is what I've been rumored. He was one of the actual demonstrators. He was, you know, did not run for re-election and get replaced like last week or something like that. So, yeah, it was one of those things where they're really trying to flex their power. And compared to, you know, I think that one seemed to have angered a lot of people. That particular one, and the one in Portland especially. A lot of more people are getting very aggravated. I can see a lot more angry rhetoric at this type of behavior. The one in Portland, let's talk about that too. There was actually two different people that were assaulted, and their vehicles were vandalized. You know, again, they're doing the same thing. There was a couple cars in the front that were kind of... they were the lead blocking vehicles, and they had the corkers on each side that ride. Those are the people that ride the bicycles, and they have the vests on, and they kind of leapfrog from intersection to intersection. And there was the first vehicle, the first incident was a van, and it was a minivan, and it's hard to tell exactly what was happening. It was like, you know, again, this is a big main thoroughfare of Portland. This one was earlier this week, like I think it was Tuesday. So they are, you know, the person is not trying to speed through. It's like, I guess they're, I don't know if they're trying to take a turn or something somewhere, but they kind of, they didn't even really get deep into the march. But whatever reason, they didn't have a rear blocker that was blocking this person, or they didn't understand what was going on. The person actually kind of pulled ahead a little bit very slowly, and you know, they seemed like they were aware of the pedestrians and were not trying to hit someone. They were just trying to get through the crowd to get where they were going. Yeah, and they immediately got surrounded, and then people started screaming and cussing at them, pointing guns. Like, there was a bunch of people there with rifles, and they were pointing rifles at this person. From the videos I saw, the ones that they did not have magazines in the rifle at that time. The thing that happens, what happens, like in Oregon, you can open carry. They have a weird thing. They don't recognize concealed carry from out of state. And, you know, you have to have a concealed carry license to open carry a loaded weapon. But if you're carrying a weapon in Portland and you're either don't have a concealed carry license or you're from out of state, you need to like open carry it, and you need to have a magazine out of the rifle or the weapon. It needs to be unloaded and not have a magazine in it. So I'm assuming the person, you know, may have been down from Washington, or several of them may have been from Washington, and the ones that weren't probably didn't, almost certainly did not have concealed carry licenses. So they were mostly carrying unloaded from what I saw. But yeah, you know, immediately the person starts pushing through and they start screaming at them, you know, threatening to kill the person, telling them to stop. And they run up there and they start smashing the rear windows out of this thing. They like pull the door open, they pull the person out, and they just like mace them in the face. And the you know, they slashed all the tires on the car, and they immediately start, you know, after this happens, they start congratulating themselves. Oh, well, we were just de-escalating. We de-escalated that situation. And that's like the first thing I want to talk about. It's like de-escalation in the context that they use this does not mean like reducing tensions, where it actually does mean reducing tensions. It means reducing tensions in the sense of you intimidate someone into compliance. It's DS, like, again, we've covered this so many times. A lot of the terms lefties use are fundamentally different. They're using some words that we use, but they use them in some very different ways. De-escalation to them means you give up and you submit and you're compliant. That's what it means to them. Like, they're not talking about we found some middle ground that everyone's happy with. They're like, you have agreed to comply with our demands, therefore the situation is de-escalated. So yeah, they smash this person's vehicle up. And again, the cops did not show up here, and they're marching through town, and the cops know when this is happening, okay? I mean, like I said, I've been in Portland, I've been undercover with them. They have informants, and they know what's going on, and no one shows up. So they keep marching, and they get into a residence. They were kind of in a thoroughfare at that point. It looked like there were some businesses, so it was not, I mean, it was the way Portland's laid out. You have the downtown area, but then you have like a bunch of other different, like little business districts and the little residential areas around them. So it was like more of a mixed use type area. But then they get into an area that is legitimately like residential. They are walking along, and they're in this residential area, and they take the turn, and there is a red truck approaching down this residential street. One of the escort vehicles in the front, like it's a Jeep, kind of pulls over a little bit to block them, but it's almost immediate. You're watching it from the live stream, and the camera turns, and you hear yelling and screaming and threats, and they immediately run out with guns. The guy, there was like, you could see a car pulling up behind him. He had another vehicle, so he was kind of blocked in. He's blocked in the front, and they kind of scooch around and let him by. Yeah, anyway, they end up like beating on his truck, and he stops, and it's just like it's kind of crazy. Like, they're blocking this guy in, pointing guns at him, cussing at him. He's yelling back at them. He pulls his gun because what does he expect to think? It's like there's these mass people with rifles, next thing all up in his face. So yeah, it's a big to do there. He ends up like he pulls some, and then he stops and gets out of his vehicle. And he was actually, I'll link the interview that was on Lars Larson again. He's not an objective narrator. He's explaining his background, and I mean, he's explaining like his experience. And of course, it's going to be filtered because he was attacked, so he's not going to be charitable and objective. But nonetheless, the video is pretty damning. He gets out and. Yeah, he gets attacked. He gets swarmed and taken down, and tackled by one of a medic. That's one of the things you have to watch out for, the medics. They willing to fight just as much as anyone else if it comes down to it. So yeah, he gets taken down. I'll have the videos and his audio, his linked interview with Lars, in the comments again. Bunch of different mistakes he made. I mean, this is ultimately not a tactical critique of him. The reality is, normal people do not expect to experience that sort of thing. You're just driving down a residential street, and apparently he said he had to turn on the residential street because there was some traffic on the main street. And next thing you're faced with an armed mob, and it's one of those things that, it's easy to say in isolation, yes, if people jump out in front of you with rifles, it's probably a I'm sorry, that's my dog in the background. She's napping on the bed. Yeah, it's probably a carjacking. That's a very common thing, but we're living in an age where there has to be some context. Unfortunately, it's like if you're depending on where you are, you have to kind of determine what you're seeing and your political climate on how you can respond to things. I mean, maybe if you're in the rural South and somebody jumps out of a bush with a rifle in front of you, you can plow them down and not have to worry about anything. If you're in a place that is hard left and there's a lot of crazy riots and a lot of these activist groups doing things, you have to be a little circumspect about what you do. If these folks jump out in front of you and block you, you're like, yeah, can I run them down? But what if they're like a protected class? Is the leftist DA going to go after me? So yeah, that's the reality is, these people, if in case you do run into them, and you never know, there's a good chance you may experience something like this. They could, you if you're driving through, even if you don't live in the city, there's a very good chance that you will drive through a city or an urban area at some point and these people are, you know, going further out into smaller towns and the suburbs. And yeah, you know, it's not something people expect. You know, you see two vehicles parked side by side in a residential street and you kind of assume they're stopped and talking, or it's some quick little exchange of, you know, equipment or parts or something, or someone dropping something off, and then, you know, a car, you see behind the car and there's a mob of people with rifles. That's a different story. The thing that stands out to me is the guy, you know, he got out of his truck, and well, several things that stand out. He got out of his truck because, according to his interview, you know, when they hit the side of his truck, he was worried about a hit and run, so he kind of jumped out to look, and then, you know, they, of course, that's when, you know, because that is another thing. It's like, you know, do you leave and potentially they call in and, you know, you get charged with hit and run, or do you stop and, you know, try to see what's going on and potentially get attacked? I mean, ideally, you know, he could have been paraphrasing or changing what he actually did, because it would have sounded bad. No one would say, I got out of the truck because I was mad, I wanted to fight them, and I got my ass beat, you know, which is a very likely, is extremely likely for what happened, but no one's going to actually say that. You know, he should have stayed in his vehicle. Realistically, in that scenario, they're aggressive and violent, but they're unlikely to shoot first for most of them. You have people like the Michael Reinhold incident, which was an ambush scenario by someone who's kind of a hanger-on for that radical left group. But when you see a mob of those folks, they've got people with them, like protest marshals, and they're going to have people that are in charge. It's not strictly as hierarchical as you may think, but there are people there that have more influence and are kind of calling the shots and kind of organizing things and planning things. So my experience is like they're much, much less likely, or at least they have been for a long time, to not use lethal force if they can help it when they're in a group, because they do understand, and this is something, you know, when I talk about violence as a switch versus a knob, they do understand that, you know, disproportionate overwhelming violence can give you a public relations disaster. So I do think they're extremely angry and violent, and they consider it another thing, and this is sort of interesting because in some circles online, left-leaning type groups, they're kind of referring to it as community self-defense. You know, the way they see it, you know, someone was mildly aggressive, which is really what happened. You know, there was no need for any of this to happen. Even if you're marching on the street without a permit or anything like that, most people, if you're marching randomly, the people that are in vehicles more than likely usually are not actively trying. They're not going to try to actively hurt you. I don't think the person that I mentioned in the van was like it. To me, it looked like someone who was just trying to make their way through a crowd of people walking so they could turn in somewhere. The guy on the truck, I don't think he was either. Like, they immediately had rifles on him before he even had a chance to do anything. I think he was kind of more shocked and angry when he saw that. And that's something you have to be aware of. You know, some of that, what they do is they're trying to get people to submit and comply, and they're also, because they're filming everything, they're also trying to get those PR victories. They're trying to get other people to overreact by getting angry. Just that provocation that we've talked about, that mid-level violence, just pushing and poking and prodding. And they want someone to flip out, and they want someone to do something that's disproportionate and looks terrible so that they can go, you know, go on the news or online and talk about, you know, the violent fascists and how they have to protect themselves. And this is why they have to carry even more guns when they're out marching. Another thing here is the cops were either did not show up for either one of these incidents, or the one or two that were there. We see in the one in Texas, we see one cop, and he's incredibly passive, doesn't really do anything, and, you know, he focuses more on moving the man who's angry about the protests out of the way. In Portland, according to the interview, you know, these people, and the thing is, in Portland, when I was undercover with these folks and they were setting police stations on fire, they knew where everyone was going. Like, this was not some secret. Like, it was they would have a meet. They were like the anarchist group, like the BLM and anarchist people would have a meetup somewhere, and you could tell it's like they would say, you know, dress in black, we're going to march at this certain time, and it wouldn't have a destination, but you could look at a map and you were pretty sure where they were going, because, you know, like, where's the nearest police station or, you know, police association building, where's the nearest government building, and that was like 99% of the time that was their target. Sometimes they would have one that was in between two different places, and you weren't quite sure which one, but generally speaking, it was like they were not going to meet somewhere then march 5 miles. You know, it was within a half mile to a mile, so you kind of knew where they were going. So they knew, and like, again, they've had several arrests from informants and undercover people, and they monitor a lot of these protests and events. You know, and they know when they're going to happen, because this was the middle of the day. So there was not like there was not much traffic on the street. People surely were calling this in. So they knew, you know, and they knew in Portland. And, you know, both of these things, like the cops in Portland, they weren't there. The man who was beaten, apparently he has a bunch of broken bones and like his orbital bone shattered. It's really kind of fucked up. I'm sorry to see. But, yeah, you know, he called the cops and he says that, you know, he's laying there. He couldn't go anywhere because they took his, they took his keys out of his car, out of his truck, so there was no way for him to leave. They took his gun and his keys. He said the cop came up and was like, "What'd you do to antagonize them?" So he, like, knew they were there. You know, the cop knew about this stuff. They knew about this. And they didn't do anything. They let these people march through town and, like, vandalize people. You know, they vandalized and threatened people. This armed crowd with rifles were marching through town for God knows how long. I mean, they usually march for a couple miles when they're doing that sort of thing. So they knew. It was probably an hour or two. So they knew. You know, they had plenty of time to get together a plan and try to, like, you know, shut this down. Of course, they didn't, because they knew if they tried to, they would have a huge-ass riot on their hands. This goes back into the stuff I talked about last year when I talked about, you know, my time undercover in Portland. You know, the cops, I mean, I don't want to say they were too aggressive, but I thought they responded appropriately the first time. I thought they pursued them a little too long, and what happened was the Antifa groups were actually leading them into residential areas where the cops were, like, shooting flashbangs and tear gas in a residential area, and it was just repeatedly pissing off the residents. Yeah, you know, so the cops did nothing, and these folks got to travel through town and basically act like a quasi-police force and just inflict violence on people, and not be harmed for it. And this is sort of the same thing that happened in, I didn't see any violence in Texas, but the cops were very much about trying to get the other person who was angry to comply and not cause problems. You know, and this is the sort of thing that we're seeing in America now, and it's really kind of concerning. And I mean, this is something that's happened throughout history, and it's, America's not immune to it. I've talked before about stuff like the Battle of Blair Mountain, the Battle of Athens. I mean, there's been plenty of violence in America, but we're reaching this point now where, you know, the radical left has these armed groups, these, you know, essentially de facto militia groups that are able to, you know, act autonomously in urban areas, and the police are afraid to confront them because of the political situation and what happened with, you know, the Chauvin situation, the way they're piling on charges with them. It's like, basically, cops now, especially if it's anyone as a person of color, they're getting hammered for stuff. So a lot of them, you know, they're getting to this stage of, like, what, smile and wave policing. And it's really concerning for the rule of law, because I'm hearing folks too, you know, I don't know where things are going to go, but I don't see it getting better for a while. You know, there was some suspicion for a while that maybe after the election they would calm down, and they sort of have. We're not getting the insane ass riots every night, which is probably, you know, it's hard to keep that intensity going for a year, and we're coming up on a year. I know it's so hard to believe that we're approaching just short of a year, 12 months, a little over 11 months of insanity since the massive riots kicked off. So they did that, and, you know, now they're going, and this, again, this goes back to what I said in one of the last pieces I wrote, where I analyzed the undercover video from Seattle. They're talking about dialing it back doing more like small unit direct action stuff. It's more closed block undercover stuff that's not announced. There's not turning out a massive group of people. And that is bookended by the other things that we've seen. We've seen these folks that are doing, all the folks have been arrested. Believe it or not, yeah, there are some that have been arrested on serious charges. There's the guy who, the girl who burned the Portland Police Association that was arrested by an undercover informant, or was arrested on information provided by an undercover informant. She is looking at like 20 years in prison. The feds put charges on her, as well as the state. So, she'll probably plead down, but still, there's a lot of these lefties that are looking at some serious federal time, like the guy who Molotov cocktailed the Portland cops. They arrested him in Indiana. So there are some situations like that. And that, looking at some of the chatter that I've seen in leftist channels, a lot of them are really concerned about where things go from here, and they're like, all right, let's dial back some. Everyone's, and there's been a lot of infighting too. I've seen a good bit of infighting. So there's folks that are dialing back towards these smaller actions, and I think we're going to see more stuff like this. These marches, they do serve a purpose for them, because now they're marching more in the daytime, and they're carrying guns, and they get to kind of force their will on the population and demonstrate to the local population that they actually have some autonomy and control, and the police can't protect them. This is a really common thing with a lot of uprisings, is, and this is something that's cartelification, with the mutual aid, and them demonstrating the capability of applying force and no one stopping them. It is something called cartelification, which is, again, like it says, it's something that we have seen a lot in Mexico. The cartel sort of takes over as a quasi-governmental organization. Like, they start actually doing stuff like minor things, helping the local community, which is something that the mutual aid societies and the medic society or collectives did during the serious riots, where they would actually, after they were getting flashbanged and tear gassed in residential neighborhoods, the medic collectives would travel through the neighborhood and give out medical supplies and instructions on like how to defend against tear gas, like how to block up your windows, how to like build an ersatz, gas mask at home to minimize the effects of having tear gas in your house. It's the principle of be useful. Like, that's how you turn people towards your side, is just be useful to them. So you've got that. You've got the carrot and the stick. You've got the carrot of the mutual aid people that are actually coming out there doing things like that, coming into town, doing their food drives and trying to be helpful. Then you've got the stick, which is these marches that travel through town and act like a militia force, which is, and like an organized militia, which again, it's like Mahdi militia overseas. It's like militia can be a militia is a neutral word. It can be used, it can be used in a negative or positive sense. There are negative and positive examples of a militia. It's inherently neutral, and in this case, these are a neutral application of the militia principle. And they're doing that. It's a bookended. It's a carrot and stick situation. The police are kind of, the police are very much starting to give way in Portland from everything that I've seen. And it was really kind of, disheartening to see it happening in Texas now, where the cops just completely, gave in. Like, I saw this the first time in person, the first time for myself in San Francisco, when we had, this was election night 2016. We, once they called it for Trump, we had a mob of people in Black Bloc out front. We were having our party in Twitter headquarters, the election watch party for the SFGOP. And as soon as they called it for Trump, we're like getting ready to leave after that, and everyone's excited and partying. And then they're like, "You have to go. We're closing down." So they start kicking us out, but like, we can't leave because there's like a mob of people in Black Bloc out front of the Twitter headquarters in San Francisco. And the cops, I remember seeing the cops looked just depressed and beat down. Like, they did not have command presence. There was just really, the body language was very unimpressive. And the cop that I saw in the Texas video reminded me a lot of what I first saw with the San Francisco police in late 2016. talking about, I'm going to segue to another point from there. Talking about the election stuff, you know, there's something about hypocrisy that I want to cover, and I want to talk about not necessarily hypocrisy itself, although we'll cover that a little bit. But I want to cover, there's a way that we respond to that that I think is very counterproductive, especially leftist hypocrisy. Now, I mean, let's talk about, for starters, the hypocrisy here. 2017, January 20, 2017, you know, we had, if you remember, after the election, what happened election night, a lot of the protests and riots and the violence that happened all in between the election all the way to Inauguration Day, there was a ton of that. There was very clear and ample warning what was going to happen on January 20th, or J20 as the lefties call it, and there was basically nothing. Like, there was a security response, but the city was, you know, there was a lot of people that I know who were there and never actually got to even go anywhere near it or go to any of the balls that night because, you know, they were just tearing the city apart. There were places on fire. There were all kinds of riots going on in D.C. that, you know, there was not a security plan to respond to that. They ended up arresting like around 200 of these people that were in one block. They ended up arresting around 200 of them. And I think they got like 6 plea deals from them, but then most of them had the charges dismissed because, well, they were wearing black, so it was very hard to identify them, but they also didn't talk to the cops. You know, they had solidarity, they didn't talk to the cops. There weren't any photos of them doing anything in an identifiable fashion. And there was lots of, you know, fundraising going on in leftist circles to pay for their defenses. In fact, I know in the Bay Area, there was an underground fashion show to fundraise over in Berkeley. The Berkeley Antifa people did this. It was an, you know, underground fashion show fundraiser to help pay for their defense. So, yeah, anyway, so you look at what happened in J20 2017, and then you sort of fast forward to what happened, you know, look at, like, January 20th, it was like the entire city was in a giant lockdown. It was like there was no question at that point that there was a completely different standard. You had, you know, 20 plus thousand, maybe 30,000 National Guard in town. Everything was walled off. The entire, like, half of the city was shut down. So you have those two different responses, and you can see, you know, two different presidents. It's like one of them was favored by the establishment and the other one was not. Of course, there's the other hypocrisy of, you know, the differences between the responses to what I like to call the Occupy Rotunda, which is what happened January 6th, which I think was tactically inept. I also think it was very counterproductive. But I can understand and empathize with a lot of the anger that people feel with everything that's been going on, compared to, you know, the way I see it, like, Occupy Rotunda was probably an understandable reaction, albeit a counterproductive one, to so much of what happened last year, which I like to call Occupy Main Street. You know, we had insane-ass riots for most of the year, and it felt like the police could not do anything. You couldn't get National Guard to respond. Trump talked about sending in the military to states that would not do anything. And if you remember, there was, it turns out Liz Cheney was the one who was behind this, you know, Republican, one of the Republican leadership. She was the person who helped get, she admitted a few days ago, she was the person who orchestrated people like Mattis and the other secretaries of defense, including her dad, the former secretaries of defense, to write a letter, basically calling Trump a fascist and saying he was threatening a coup when he was just talking about, you know, activating the Insurrection Act to try to put down the riots that were across the country, burning cities. Just a reminder, this is the most destructive riots in American history. They just basically covered pretty much the entire nation. So yeah, you know, we had that going on, and it's another thing, you know, like we saw this hypocrisy, like with George Floyd, you know, people And also when John Lewis died, who was the congressman, you know, you had the Ark of St. Floyd in his golden casket. Everyone else is limited to like 10 people per funeral, but you know, Floyd is carried around the country in his golden casket and, you know, put up and for worship in these churches that are packed, that probably had tens or 100,000 people come to all of his cumulative funerals. And then John Lewis, you know, there's his funeral. You have some live stream footage from inside the church, and there's probably 1,000 people inside there. So you had these sorts of things, and they're just like in the public eye and everyone's face. And, you know, it's hypocritical, and it's easy to lock up on that word hypocrisy and just assume it's hypocrisy without really exploring some of the concepts behind it and why they do that. It's basically those sorts of things. When you see that, it's hypocrisy has a point. I mean, there's the hypocrisy that we see in day-to-day life, which I actually don't think is always a bad thing. Like, you know, look, the reality is we have things that we believe in and that we try to hold ourselves to, but we fall short. You know, we're weak people. You know, we're flesh and blood, and we're going to fall short of the ideals that we profess, and we're going to do that a lot. You know, we are flawed people, and we are sinners. We're sinners in the hands of an angry God, but yeah, you know, we're going to do that. I know I've done that so many times myself. I know so many other people that have done the same. And I'm sure anyone who's listening to this has heard it. You know, we've been there. You know, we've said something and we ended up not falling through or being weak. But this is not about weakness. I mean, this is the opposite of weakness. The hypocrisy that we're seeing is power. You know, it's like the individual hypocrisy that we do in our day-to-day life is weakness. The hypocrisy that we see orchestrated at the level we have been seeing it for over a year now, actually even the 4 years now, or hell, even longer than that. But the ones that over the last year are about power. It's about, you know, Schmitt's sovereignty, Carl Schmitt's sovereignty, his definition of the sovereign. You know, the German jurist Carl Schmitt, his definition of the sovereign was he who decides the exception. Every rule has to have an exception at some point. Like, you know, there's a point where people say, okay, this applies, this does not apply. And that's an exercise of power, which is an exercise of sovereignty. This leads me to the point I want to say about we have to be very careful how we criticize hypocrisy, because we can inadvertently reinforce the feeling of power, that the existence of exception, if we criticize it the wrong way. And if I see you do something, If you preach in your personal life and I criticize you in your personal life about some blatant piece of hypocrisy that you commit, when your hypocrisy comes from weakness, then I can undermine the point you're making. When your hypocrisy is an exercise of sovereignty, then I reinforce your power. When someone is being hypocritical or not following, or an entity or an institution or government is not following the principle that they espouse, when you bring it to their attention or the public's attention, you're doing two things. Number one, you're basically, you know, illuminating the fact that they are operating from exception. They are doing that sovereign exception, like the George Floyd, you know, funeral, which was infuriating, the John Lewis funeral, which was infuriating, which were hypocritical. From a, you know, like I said, from a citizen level, it was hypocritical, but it was also an expression of raw power. So you're reminding people that you're watching someone exercise raw power when it's acting at an institutional or government level. You're also, even worse, even the more dangerous part, you're reinforcing the point that they want to make, the moral argument, the moral principle that they are espousing but not following. You're reinforcing that. And this is a trap I see gun people, but also, like, especially libertarians fall into a lot. Like the defund the police stuff. You have a situation where there's a lot, you know, people are rightfully angry about what happened last year during the riots, you know, or even before the riots, during the lockdown stuff. Cops are trying to enforce stuff. It got stupid and idiotic. So people are angry at the cops, and there's also people who are, we've seen a lot of video. The media has been doing this a lot. You saw this last year. The media will take video out of context, chop it up, show and make claims that are simply false, that are flat out inflammatory, to spark more riots, because we live in, we live in a clickbait age. So they'll make it, like we saw this with, Micaiah Bryant, and we talked about, they were claimed some girl was shot and she wasn't doing anything, and they're like, oh well, there was a knife somewhere in the vicinity, and then we see the body camera footage and like she's like mid slice with a knife when the guy drew and shot her. That's what you see the media doing a lot, because it gets those clicks. It drives that rage click, which is more lucrative than a light click or a cute click, like a puppy click or something like that. People rage click more. So you have that sort of thing where, the reality is, and what we've seen since the Floyd riots is like there's been, immediately after the lockdowns, crime dropped a little bit. Of course, everything's still fuzzy because it won't be till later this year for they have the really good numbers, but before they're all like collated. But initial indications are looking like starting around like end of May, which what happened the end of May, the violent crime really started exploding, and it looks like murders up somewhere around ballpark 20%, maybe higher, 20% year over year, which still is well below things that we've experienced in living memory. Like I think it was higher in the late 80s and early 90s, but this rate of increase is essentially unprecedented. It's something I don't think we've ever seen as long as rates have been recorded. And the result of that was, I think there's around 2020, there's roughly ballpark, they said it was something like 3,000 extra dead blacks. I mean, how good is that for the black community when you've got, okay, there's around a little under 250, blacks are shot every year or killed by cops every year. Overwhelmingly, the majority of those are justified. I think there's around 12. Roughly, it averages between 10 to 15 are unarmed. And even, it's completely possible for a justified shoot to still be on an unarmed person. That's a much more complicated discussion we're not going to get into. But yeah, it's like you've seen this where cases, Michael Brown or whatever, and which was justified, and all these other incidents, and we've seen this more as body cameras come out. A lot of these incidents are justified. So we're worried around 250 blacks that are being shot every year. And we want to reduce policing in the black communities, or policing overall, but especially in the black communities, because the concern is that the black, policing in black communities leads to blacks being shot by cops. But the problem is, okay, we depolice the communities and we pull back. Cops are not patrolling like they used to, and crime's exploded, and there's, 3,000 extra dead blacks. Was that worth it? I don't really think so. I mean, I think this is something that people have a hard time talking about and really trying to deal with, which is, the issues that are going on in the black community. We can't even really touch on that. It's just people are mortified to even hint at any of the issues happening there. But the hypocrisy part comes in with this, because you have like Biden, who's now talking about the menthol cigarette ban, and now people are jumping on that, and even whether or not you like menthol cigarettes or things that should be banned, which I don't think so. The argument that they're choosing, that people are choosing to attack this ban on, are, police coming into contact with blacks. They're reinforcing, even taking that argument, because it's an argument that has already been teed up. People feel confident swinging for it, to argue against the menthol ban. But in fact, they're only reinforcing the concept that we need to have less police interaction with blacks for black safety, which, we're 3,000 extra dead blacks last year from depolicing. I fairly sure I don't think that's a positive trade. That's one example of this. Another one is the concept. You see a lot of this where some of these communities, LGBTQ and other minority communities, of like, yeah, we need to, these people need guns because of the big, bad, evil rednecks that are hunting them. People are trying to get trying to get more people to join the gun community and adopt firearms has led a lot of gun rights activists into the minefield of advocating a lot of very woke ideology. I mean, the reality is, you know, white people are the least racist people in this country. It's mostly not like I'm not going to say it doesn't happen. There's 330 million people in the country, but I personally have never had anyone. Yeah, I've never had an incident with crazy rednecks being transphobic or mean to me or anything like that. The only time anyone has ever actually said anything to me that was transphobic was a black person in D.C., which I'm fairly sure they weren't Republican. I'm just going to just guess that. Those are some of my ideas there on my observations on what I have seen with people that, you know, again, it's there's something strange. I don't know what it is about the right-wing mind, but it just seems like the folks that I deal with a lot, like, I feel like a lot of the lefties that you talk and, like, follow, like, they have a better strategic grasp. I suspect it's mainly a thing about it's not anything intrinsic. I think it's probably just more, you know, of an attitudinal thing as well as not having the background or the training to really kind of see a lot of these tactics that are being used. But, you know, I see a lot where especially kind of centrist or right-leaning people will take a position for short-term advantage that, you know, undermines them in the long-term strategically. And I think this is a great example of that. It's one that is kind of frustrating to me. Like, yeah, it's like you'll see this thing get teed up and, you know, you just have to, you know, it's like it looks like an easy, you know, looks like an easy strike or whatever, and, you know, you swing for it and it ends up being a trap strategically because you undermined your larger principles because you just wanted to make a short-term point. You know, and it's another thing too, when you say these things, you know, people have this tendency where, you know, the cognitive dissonance, they don't like believing, they don't like saying things that they don't believe. So if you make people say things long enough, or they can be induced to repeat something over a while, you know, instead of being humiliated constantly, they'll find reasons to believe something. And that's another thing that concerns me is, you know, if you can use the carrot instead of the stick to convince people to chant certain platitudes, after a while, you know, a certain number of those people will adopt those platitudes, and the ones that don't are going to be afraid to admit that they really don't actually believe those platitudes, because there's a certain number of people in the group that very clearly do believe those, and there's, you know, some insecurity about, you know, who doesn't believe it. So it's an interesting psychological thing I picked up on. I hope you find it interesting. Definitely let me know. I get feedback pretty regular on my content, and I always appreciate it. I have this piece, I'm working on another piece and writing all week, like I said. Have this last piece finished here tonight. Tomorrow, that's going off to the publisher, and that should be out in a month or two. In the print mags, I'll let you know where to read them. I think you'll find them very interesting and very topical. I'm very excited about this opportunity. Yeah, cool. And then I'm going to get right back out to my regular stuff because I have my plate cleared. Anyway, with that, I'm going to let you run for tonight. Thanks so much for tuning in. Hope this was insightful and thoughtful. And as always, I really enjoy feedback and people emailing me and just reaching out. Again, awesome. Thank you. This is Aaron, the Contextual Intelligent Project.